welcome back to The Therapy Show. This is episode 10 of our first season and series of episodes. If we lived in the UK, it'd be series. Here it's season. That's how we do things here in these United States. Unless you're in Sweden. And then I don't know what they do for their TV. They don't even have TV. What do they have over there? What do you guys watch?
I don't know. We don't even have a TV, so I can't tell you.
No TV right now. I think they just kind of watch what we watch, because all my friends over there just talk about cool shows that are on now. So I think I think Hollywood still owns the world or something.
They do.
Yeah. In a weird way. We're back, and it's been a couple of weeks. Thank you, everybody, for being patient with us as we worked out schedules and got this going. So today's episode is one I think it would be impossible not to get something out of if you are a living, breathing human being. Because as far as I know, the only true constant in our lives, unless you live in the same hut you were born in and never left it, except to kill a gopher or whatever you do and eat it, you know, the one thing that would tie us all together as one common thing in humanity, among many, but one in particular, is that change is a thing everyone has to deal with.
Yep.
Whether it be small changes, big sweeping changes, it could come in the form of we're moving to a new house or a new place, a new location, which you certainly can relate to. And then all the complications that come with that change, because it isn't just simply, hey, we moved to Sweden. It's, hey, we moved to Sweden with four kids, a husband in college, a still trying to sort of do a therapy thing on the, not on the side, but still have to do it. And now the hours are weird. And, oh, we got to find a place to live. And, oh, blah, 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 like a trillion things that go with that change. For somebody else, it might be, I'm having gender reassignment surgery. And it's not as simple as just, I've got a pair of boobs and a vajayjay now. I've got this mile-long list of everything else that changes when I had that done.
Yeah.
Socially and in my family and in my whatever, my own head, my hormones, whatever. So I thought it'd be interesting to try to attack the idea of dealing with change in one's life. And again, these changes can be small or large. But I mean, wouldn't it be true if I said every day of everyone's life has something in it that can be defined as change?
Well, yeah, age. We're aging every minute. We're dying every minute.
We're one step, one day closer to whatever my death date is.
Yeah. I don't know what happens at 38, but I can work out really hard and wake up sore the next morning. Mm-hmm. Or I don't have to work out at all and I still wake up sore.
Yeah, what's that about?
I think there's a moment where you go from being the kid who can sleep on a floor in a weird position and not have any consequences to your joints and your muscles and your bones are just getting old, right? Mm. So yes, changes every minute of every day. But I mean, the way the human brain works is it adjusts for change by getting used to it, right?
Yeah.
And so think of something just like in your normal life. Like, okay, when you moved to your new house, what was obvious?
A year ago this next week, by the way.
Perfect. Yeah. Okay. So what now doesn't even catch your attention, but when you first got there was really obvious? And it could be just trying to find home or trying to find the store or whatever, right?
For me, it was so they, where I live now, they opted, when they did all the floor plans and stuff around the neighborhood, they opted to go with this kind of Midwestern idea of pulling in, and like all the driveways are in the rear of the house and you access it, and everybody on your street accesses theirs, with a couple of exceptions, via an alleyway, a common shared one. And this is a real common, like Minnesota and other parts of the Midwest, is kind of how you do everything. But here where I live, normally, not, you know, prominently anyway, most people got a front door, and just to the left or right of that is your garage door, and you park in that garage, or there's your driveway to park, your parkway or whatever, covered parking. It's all right up front. There's none of this like go behind the thing. And it took me, I don't know, a couple of weeks to just get my head around. I'd be entering from the back, and the front's not the same, and it's not accessible from the front. You have to go through the house to get to the back. Like this weird, it's a small thing. It's a structural thing, but it weirded me out and I had a hard time with it for a while. Like how to park there and all that.
It's kind of dumb.
Yeah. But now that I've explained it, it sounds super dumb, but that reminds me of something that at first was weird.
That's actually a perfect example, because you parked in the, now you can do it without thinking, right?
Yeah. No, it's no big deal. I just do what I do now.
So, I mean, we've talked about mirror neurons a little bit on the show before. In essence, they've discovered in the last couple of years, that we have neurons that in essence train us, or that get activated and help us observe something and then do it. So we mirror the things we're watching. So a baby learning to walk, we're now realizing there's some mirror neurons that are activated, and they're observing everyone else walking. It's sort of like they're sitting on the floor going, yeah, look how's people doing this thing, and I can't do that, but I'm going to try to do that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a very basic version of it. We use it with pattern recognition when we're going through a home for the first time. It's activating brand new circuitry in a place we've never been. We live in this very old farmhouse. Yeah. There is one bathroom on the bottom floor. All the bedrooms are upstairs, so that there's no night peeing that goes on around here. We have bottles in all the rooms. No, I'm just kidding. But it's just the design from 1840. They apparently only went to the bathroom, and they probably got up at 3 a.m. to work on the farm. So whatever, you don't need.
Probably never need to pee at night. Sure.
Exactly. No one had lived long enough to have prostate problems or something. I don't know.
Sure.
But so the first couple nights, I was sure we're all going to die, right? Because you don't know where you are, and it's dark, and the stairs are scary. And then where the heck is the bathroom? And there's all the doorways are a little shorter because everyone was apparently short in 1840, right?
Yeah,
so you have to duck. Anyway, it was kind of an obstacle course and scary at first, but you activate all those mirror neurons. And they're used for other things too, but this is kind of a general.
Could you apply it to like a 16 or 15-year-old kid learning how to drive? It's the same idea, right?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Right. So then you start to remember where you are in space. Like just before our call, I walked upstairs in the dark and I was feeling around, but I had a general sense of, you know, we've only been here 3 weeks, but I still kind of know where things are because that's enough time for those neurons to start to piece together. Sort of, it's why we get good at Tetris when we practice, right? You start to see patterns and where things go and all of that stuff starts to happen better and better and better. Right. So what happens is we're facing change constantly. But we have this equipment in our brain to adapt. And eventually things that were difficult become easy. This is why people become good at sports or music, or, you know, practice becomes, so you can do it without thinking. And so that is one way that change is just kind of relevant to everybody.
Yeah.
But then we can extrapolate that to bigger things, right? You know, for me, it was just like 2 days ago, I was in the store, and you should see me. I've got my phone out and I am translating because I'm buying crap I don't mean to buy. And I don't know what this says. And, you know, I'm buying things that just don't even make sense. And then I take them home and wasting money because everything's three times as expensive here. Anyway, and it's so stressful. And I went to the store 2 days ago and I knew what I was looking at. It just suddenly happened. And that was weird. I was not expecting for it to be from like one shopping trip to the next. Right. But it's such a cool feeling, right? And what it does is suddenly reduces my stress by half, right? I still am sweaty and hate the grocery store here.
Right.
Because I'm a hoarder and I can't get enough crap.
Well, because it's all going to go, like we talked about a couple weeks ago, it's all going to go bad before you eat it. So
yeah, I have like 5 minutes because there's no plastic in it or whatever.
Sure.
Anyway, but there's also this like, I don't know what anyone's saying and how do I pay for this? I want to make sure, you know, I don't want to look like an idiot. It's just like the rest of you in your native countries going to the store, you don't even think about this. But if anyone has moved to another country and gone grocery shopping, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It takes so much of your energy to do. And so the brain is really smart in the sense of it needs to reduce its energy output. It is taking up all our calories for the most part, right? Mm-hmm. It burns and needs so much to work the way it does best. It's going to simplify this process. So it's going to eliminate the things it doesn't need to pay attention to and focus on what it needs to and learn so you can do things without thinking. So we're actually built to do this so that, and so the stress goes away And suddenly you're capable of doing other things because the brain is no longer stressed just by getting food.
Isn't it the thing that makes us the most unique of the mammals? Because they, you know, we're always amazed that a dog can learn some crazy new thing you've never seen a dog do before, because they're not supposed to be able to think or adapt outside their boundaries.
Right.
But yet we seem to have what we at least perceive, because we can't see beyond whatever our boundaries are, but we seem to have unlimited ability to adapt and to change and, you know, exist where we weren't, you know, not supposed to live in the desert, but we'll figure out a way. Well, now Phoenix exists somehow.
Exactly.
Things like that. Yeah.
Well, one thing I love is I was telling our sister-in-law, Becky, who lives in Phoenix, when she comes to Salt Lake in the summer, she's cold.
Yeah,
wears
crazy.
A sweater in 100 degree heat because it's too cold, you know.
Yeah.
There's actually an enzyme that can be found in the blood of people who live in hot places and people who live in cold places. And now I'm going to get it backwards, but an enzyme that basically you've adapted to the temperatures that you're used to. And you can actually find physical evidence in your bloodstream with these enzymes that help basically balance. That's why someone who's used to being hot all the time gets really cold in what should be above body temperature. That should be warm in theory, right?
Right.
And then vice versa with people in the cold. They're also, anyway, yeah. It's because we adapt, right? Yeah. And then you could live somewhere for a while and eventually adapt. And so all of that's awesome because it just reduces our stress, so then our energy can be put somewhere else. But then there's the other kind of change. There's not the mirror neurons figure out how to walk around in your farmhouse kind of get used to change. It is the a relationship is a certain way. Mm-hmm. And then that person doesn't respond to you the same way, or they die, or they get sick, or, you know, circumstances. So what we are used to and we can do without thinking is suddenly thrown on its head. And then we do this thing, is we have a story about how that's supposed to work. And then when it changes, we don't relinquish that story very quickly.
Yeah. Even on the small stuff, you know, like I'm not used to that light switch being there because I moved. That sucks. You stupid light switch. I'm pissed. This should change. But, but that's so dumb, you know, that we, because the minute somebody comes in and says, here's a more socially relevant example. It's like, hey, your new neighbors next door, they're gay and they have a kid. What are you going to do about that? And then the husband's like, you know, and his narrative kicks in, right? Because that's what he's used to. That's what it is. And this kind of change is not a kind of change he's ever had before. But chances are, unless he's crazy, he'll get used to that too.
Yeah.
And that guy will have just as good a weed whacker to go borrow as any other guy next door. Like, it's all going to be fine.
Right.
But he doesn't think so.
But you just maybe hit on what helps the narrative change, and that is exposure.
Yeah.
So if you stay in your house and tell yourself that those neighbors are awful and they're terrible parents and they should not be allowed to live in your neighborhood or whatever the story is, and you never interact with them, because you could do that.
Yeah, you could.
Then there's no change. There's no mirror neurons that get activated. We have mirror neurons that activate when we're looking at each other's faces, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's so obvious to me when I'm with a client who has a certain distinct mannerism when they talk or with their hands, because by the end of the session, I find myself doing it.
Oh, really? Because you'll
literally
mirror what they're doing.
Yeah, I'm literally mirroring. And because part of what I'm doing is mirroring on purpose.
Yeah.
But then suddenly I notice, like, whoa, I'm doing that voice they do.
Yeah.
I'm sure they feel just connected, but I get a little creeped out that how easily that happens because I'm aware of what's happening. But that is what ultimately is happening with a neighbor. When we're interacting with them, our mirror neurons are activating. We're finding likeness. So there's something to be said, and there's a lot of science behind this too. We're very drawn to likeness. I read a quote that I thought was super funny once that said, if you meet crazy people and you find yourself saying, me too,
yeah,
then embrace these people because they're your tribe. Like, crazy people are your tribe. And really, there's something that happens in the me too, right? Mm-hmm. It's, oh, you like that band too? Me too. You know, you it sort of breaks down those barriers, and the sameness makes you more comfortable,
sure,
makes you act more yourself. It's all those good things. So you cannot break any of those down unless there's exposure and conversation. That's why anyone who's anti-gay, anti-black, anti-woman,
whatever
anti-
it
whatever,
is, they're anti, sure.
Whatever you're anti, okay, maybe you're anti-white supremacist.
Yeah.
But I still think if you spent a couple hours with like a nice one, some of those mirror neurons would kick in and there would be at least some kind of, and maybe that's not true. I don't know, but
is a fair point. Like people say, if you just, you know, there's some documentarian will spend a bunch of time with a serial killer. What they walk away with isn't like, oh, I've been swung around to this idea of, I also want to kill people. That's not what we're right. saying here. But what you have done is you've gotten away from the black and white two-dimensional cartoon in your head of what this guy is. And what you've walked away again with is the much more realistic and complicated version of who this guy is, which is somebody who is completely twisted, has all these problems, but has this one part of him that is weirdly kind-hearted, or this other part of him that is weirdly super smart and educated, or you know, it's not that you're trying to, well, I need to see this serial killer to make sure I know what a good guy he is under all this. But what you're walking away with is a more nuanced understanding of the granularity of the human condition and not just this, you know, snidely whiplash sort of vision of who people are.
Right. And that, it also might, you know, it also might be that they are really evil, right? And
sure.
You're not seeing much good, but what you do is on some level see humanness because that's what you're looking at,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
When you avoid, when we jail them away, when there's, you know, your neighbor you never talk to, you can create all sorts of prisons that you never actually come face to face with somebody. So you can't activate the parts of your brain that make us actually the most unique. So this is why we anthropomorphize animals, right?
Sure.
We see emotions and we see human traits because we are wired to do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that makes us more compassionate, right?
Sure.
When we see humanness, let's call it that, in another species or in actual people. Because any kind of assault, any kind of violence against another human being or, you know, sort of bigger picture war, that kind of thing, you have to dehumanize before you can harm someone. Like, do you remember as a kid? Oh, what is that song? Is it a Sting song about the Russians love their children too?
Yeah, that is a Sting song.
Yeah, that was totally on the radio here the other day. What? There's a weird radio station.
Yeah, what is going on there at the radio? That's
the oldest American songs. They are bizarre. Anyway, but that idea that like until I remember hearing that song and thinking, oh my gosh, I've never thought of that the Russians love their children too.
Yeah.
Because they had you terrified, right? Like mm-hmm. we're all going to nuke each other. Mm-hmm. And we're not like that old that it was at the height of that, but it was left over for sure, right?
Sure.
And so that dehumanizing is necessary really for people to kill each other or for sort of assaults.
Right. And there's a reason why you see a puppy and go, oh, because what you've got there is a thing that has been bred to mimic the eyes and face of an infant, really.
Yeah.
And they're cute because you're having all this pattern recognition. If dogs were a little body with a cube head and no expression, just a square or something, I don't know that we'd feel the way about dogs we do, even though you could have the exact same brains and thought patterns, whatever theirs are, and instincts and all that stuff could be identical. But because we have made them into people, basically, into children, that's why they're so appealing to us. So one little look up at you and a whimper doesn't mean that he's looking at you and thinking all the things you think he's thinking about you. Like the connection isn't necessarily what you think that connection is. Like, for example, whenever I see somebody, this is kind of an offshoot and I don't mean it to be, but when somebody's training a dog to do amazing things, which is always, it always blows my mind what a dog is capable of doing. Right. It always ends with food. Always. So what that tells me is they're not doing it for another fresh set of human-like motivations. They're doing it because every time they do this weird thing you've made them do, they get food for it.
Right.
It's just an animal instinctual reaction to everything. Some people, I guess we're like that in some ways, you know, the Pavlovian, whatever thing can kick in with people, but don't know why I brought that up. I just think it's funny because I've always said, I know what it is. If I ever died, like my dog Daisy would just eat me. She wouldn't care. Like, I think she's sweet and loving and she wants to cuddle up next to you and lick your hand and all the things that dogs do. But she's hungry, supersedes everything. She just eat the decaying, bloated body that no one knows about in the living room. That's what would happen. Right. It's true, dude.
Right.
Dogs are weird that way, and I think we've all put too much stock in their cute little faces. That's all I'm saying.
Right, right. Well, we fall for the face because we also created them that way, right? Yeah, we breed them to look that way. We pick the breeds that are such and such, and you know. But there's something about that compassion that sort of emerges from seeing the likeness, right? This is why parents, I think genetically, this is why they look like us.
Yeah.
There is a recognition or a sameness, right? That we find, I mean, that's why any mother finds her baby adorable when it could be the ugliest baby in the world.
Right.
There has to be some semblance of recognition. And you can even say, that's true of people we're around. I mean, one time I noticed my good friends from high school, there's a bunch of us. We are all tall. And there's like one shorty.
Yeah.
And we always thought she was super midget, but she's like 5'6".
Yeah. Which isn't that short, but like,
we think she's a midget.
You guys are the freaks.
Yeah. And yet like we sort of just congregated together, interestingly. And not that was the only motive to be friends, like, oh, you're tall. Okay. You're in the doll group. But yeah. It just sort of happens. I think we tend to do that. So I think it's natural when political parties align or, you know, the cool kids cuddle together at, you know, the lunchroom table or whatever. You've got sort of this sameness tribal thing that occurs. And all of that is part of what keeps us surviving and all that good stuff. But then how does that connect to the question, which is, you know, how do we handle change? We all face change. What do we do with change?
Well, I think, just a side note, I feel like that is all connected. Like racism, for example, feels like a problem with pattern recognition.
Right.
Like at the core science level, it's got less to do with the emotions surrounding it and all the political things that pop up around it. But when it really came down to it, the beginning of it anyway, it is that person doesn't look like me. Therefore, who has more power at the moment? Okay, I do. Okay, cool. Then I will assert my power, and that thing that doesn't look like me will not be allowed to hang around me, or they will be subservient to me, or they're less than me because I say so. But it's all back to that weird science of
and
that
would be overt racism. That thinking on a conscious level. But I think there are plenty of people who are not overtly racist, but on an unconscious level, it's a feeling of discomfort, not being around similarness, similarity, whatever. Yeah. So a perfect example is the studies they've done when they've done resumes, and they will have identical resumes. They'll send them into the same company, and they'll give the only thing they'll do is change the name. So it'll be a gender difference. Or there will be like a black sounding name like Letitia versus Mary on an application. And the racism is crazy obvious, right? And you think, is that over? I mean, is it really like a racist dude running HR? Like, we will not have black people in this, you know, department. I don't think so. I think it is a black sounding name and that person's not black, and it's a difference, right?
Yeah.
They're more comfortable with the name Mary, and Letitia could be the super white girl, who knows, but they have no other than there's some stereotype kind of names. Right?
Right.
Anyway, I think there is something about that keeps haunting us as a people. There is some interesting, you know, like African Americans in France have a very different experience. Like racism in that sense doesn't exist against black people, but people of other ethnicities have a real hard time there. And I've known of some people from the States who are black that wanted to live in France for that very reason. It was like going to another planet in some ways. There was no narrative about it, right? It was sort of like, okay. You're black, who cares?
Right.
Right. And what a difference that makes. So I don't think it's across all places and is exactly the same everywhere. But definitely in the States, there is a, I think it's the history. I think it's the, you know, it's a big country. I don't know if you guys realize how big America
is. Oh, it's huge. It's huge with lots of open spaces.
It's insane. And I sometimes I realize, like, I'm in a country of 9 million people.
Yeah, you're like a little sliver.
Like, less than LA.
Yeah. Yeah. That's nothing. It's crazy. Like, you're the size of, I mean, isn't this literally the size, like, geographically speaking, is like, what, California or something?
It's pretty tall. Like, you know, it takes probably 20 hours to drive the whole thing. I mean, I don't really know.
Yeah. But it's long and skinny.
It's long. Yeah. Yeah. Geographically, it's pretty good size, but it is like 9 million people. It's LA. It just blows my mind.
That's crazy.
Okay. Anyway, I'm sidetracked by the racism. Oh, the change. Okay. So going back to my point about uncomfortableness. And that to me is where change is a kick in the pants for most people, mm-hmm. right? It is inevitable. It's death, taxes, and change, right? So change is always coming. And I think there's a couple components. One is our story about what that change is. Because you'll meet people who are moaning about how their life is, and then something great happens and they keep moaning. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, what? Yeah. And then you just realize that is the narrative in their life, that they're miserable and nothing's good enough, and or they're entitled to all this happening and it's not, or, you know, those people are grumpy and pretty toxic and we tend to like to avoid them. But it's, and we all do it to some extent, right? We kind of have a narrative about how our life is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes from all different sources. I mean, I don't know about you, but my narrative about money comes from dad and his, like, make a bunch of money, lose it all.
Oh yeah, no question.
Make some money, lose it all. And I didn't absorb the narrative that you probably did, which is I'm the I gotta have a job and provide for my family. You know, I have the you're just lucky if you have anything narrative, right? And so I can just sort of see anything as a bonus, because mm-hmm. anything is more than nothing, and nothing is what I kind of expected.
Yeah.
Right. That's sort of the narrative. And so we can grow up in the same house, have the same experience, but our narrative about a certain topic can be very different, which makes couples really interesting mm-hmm. because you both come from your own family of origin narratives and how we view certain things. And then, you know, they clash, and that's fun.
Sure. I mean, if you're all right. So let's say, okay, so somebody says, hey, I'm going to college, okay? Let's just take some kids. You know what? Better yet, let's say it's an adult. They've been in a career their whole lives, and suddenly they're 35, and they're changing careers because for whatever reason, the market they're in before is going to crap, and they need another job. They need to provide for their family. They got three kids at home, and he's making a huge shift. He's going from, I don't know, let's say a computer game designer to being a getting a teaching certificate and teaching high school math.
Okay.
That's a pretty massive change, yeah. right? When people are thrust into change, I feel like they have a pretty good instinctual way of dealing with it. Like, if you throw me into a craziness, there's a great trailer out right now for this new movie called Tomorrowland, which is roughly based on Disneyland's Tomorrowland. It's a Disney movie. But it's a story about, best I can tell anyway, somehow George Clooney's in it. I don't know what his role is, but directed by Brad Bird, who did The Incredibles and The Iron Giant, and the guy's awesome. So I'm excited on that level alone. But this girl walks into this place, clearly some kind of juvenile court system thing. She's out of juvie and is getting her personal effects back after being in lockup or lockdown. Mm-hmm. And the cops saying, all right, we got this stick of gum, this stuff, wallet, whatever, pushing it all toward her. And one of them is this weird little symbol, looks like a pin. And she says, this isn't mine. He says, what are you talking about? And she goes, this. And she goes to grab it to show him. And as soon as she touches it, she's immediately, very effectively on screen. It's a really cool effect. But she's immediately in a big, giant, open, wide field of hay. Or not hay, wheat, like a wheat field in the middle of yeah. some giant place like Kansas or something. And then as soon as she lets go, she's back in this dark, dank, you know, juvenile hall checkout room. And every time she touches it, she's immediately transformed into that other place. I feel like that's easier. If you throw me into something where I'm completely, totally blindfolded me and then drop me in the middle of a riot somewhere, I had all of my raw, most basic instincts kick in for survival. I've got to figure out how to deal with this sudden change.
Right.
The ones that kill people are the, I'm not going to be a computer programmer anymore. I'm going to be a teacher in a high school, and I've got to do all of this differently. And right. also, not only that, I know I have 6 months till I do it, till I'm there. And I've got 6 months to stew on it and overthink it and overplan it and
doubt it.
Doubt
and
it.
Panic.
Panic. And yeah, all that stuff. That's yeah. where I feel like people listening to this might want to know how that can be dealt with differently. Because I think thrusting us into something, as much as we may not want that, and there's certainly people out there who may constantly have anxiety about being thrust into something suddenly.
Right.
It's the harder one is the one with all the buildup and all of the expectation and not knowing how to handle that transition.
Right. And all the transition of your daily life. So on Tuesdays, I usually get up and I do this. And now I'm never doing that again. I'm doing this new thing. Or, you know, and even the thrusting, like say someone suddenly dies, someone, you know, that's integral in your life, or a divorce, or someone leaves, or, you know, whatever, is your daily life doesn't work like it used to. The things, so again, the mind and the brain is very efficient. It will eliminate paying attention to many things so it can focus on what you choose to focus on. But if you had to focus on every sound, every color, every, you know, you would never get anything done or even leave your house because your brain would explode. So it has to eliminate all the background noise. And the thing with change, especially if it's stark, it suddenly brings everything into sort of greater relief, right? Mm-hmm. You notice a lot more. Like people who have diagnoses that, you know, they're terminal, it's like suddenly putting all of your priorities in a totally different space, right? Because right. you don't have any more time. Mm-hmm. Which I think we all, that's the irony. We get in cars that we are going to die in, but we don't even think about it, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that's, we think we'll live forever, even though maybe we think about death or we worry about it, or even if we know it's not that far away and we're older or something, it isn't until the doctor's like, you got 3 weeks before you have this sort of, you know, bright focus on these things that maybe matter or that you really care about, or you see things you weren't looking at before. So, though, and that's also not what you're talking about. You're talking about somebody who it's just a shift, something they probably didn't choose. Like that tends to be where people get stuck the most. They didn't choose the change.
Yeah.
Right. There's going to be those who it's my dream to do this and the change is hard, but they can keep the vision of what they're trying to do. That tends to help. Sure.
That's a good point.
And that's really the answer, right? Mm-hmm. The answer is in how people manage change well. So I will give you a great example of this massive change in our lives to Sweden that has been, I actually didn't even realize I was doing it until a friend emailed me and she just said, are you homesick? And I was thinking about like, what does homesick even mean? Like, what does that even mean? And I defined it back in the email. I just said, what homesickness is when you look in front of you and the things in front of you are not as pleasant to you as the things you left at home, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not having that experience, but there's a reason. Yes, it's stressful and sweaty to go to the grocery store. I do miss the grocery. I'll be honest about that. I miss Costco. All right. But what it is that every time I have a moment where what's right before me is like, oh, that's a lot of work. Or, holy crap, this is really foggy and I got to drive in this because there was some serious fog this morning.
Yeah.
I have this quick switch in my brain that says, you're in Sweden, dude. Like you are like living the dream right now. Like this is what you planned for 5 years. You're really going to moan about fog, or are you going to see fog as one of the most beautiful, weirdest weather things in the world? And so there's this quick flip. Now, I don't know how I train my head to do this, but it does it so quickly. So I can't, I'm not able to get stuck in, oh, I really wish I had that. Because in each moment, it's sort of this awareness of what a gift this moment is, right? Mm-hmm. I think it might be, you know, I'm dying in 6 months. Look at the sunrise.
Right.
appreciation, because I know this isn't forever. And, you know, it was a fairly huge sacrifice to get here. I'm going to enjoy every dang minute.
Right.
Yeah. So the question is, how do you apply that to sort of a humdrum change in someone's life that, you know, it's unwanted. It's hard to keep that perspective. So give me an example, because of course I'm in the middle of this example that's really, really extreme in some ways.
Sure.
What do you do when, and it can even be a positive thing, but how do you get your mind to go back to, I guess, gratitude's the word, or appreciation, or sometimes I think the word entitlement applies here. I'm like entitled to an easy, straightforward, get me what I want life.
I think some people feel that way. Yeah,
for sure. As opposed to just sort of being amazed that you have the things you have, and you know, you're alive, or you know, that type of thing. So do you have an example of sort of a humdrum thing for you that is maybe that your narrative got challenged? Maybe it's that it's not wanted.
It's interesting. I hadn't really thought about this, but so, yeah, I got a good one here actually. So,
okay.
And I think people can relate to this one. When you are feeling bad, so like last year I had a stupid medical thing that's thankfully not bugging me anymore, but was kind of rotten for a few months there. And the entire time it was very hard for me to get away from thinking the kind of thinking that is, the whole, it's the classic why me syndrome.
Yeah.
I'm not supposed to get this. I'm supposed to somehow be above this, where this is for other people, you know, that thing. Mm-hmm. And you would then be reminded of somebody's horrible cancer treatment, or somebody else, you know, dying in some terrible way, or somebody whose kids were both killed in a car accident while they were with a babysitter or something, or you know, some hideous thing. And you would be like, why am I complaining about this manageable thing that I have?
Right.
That is mostly my own fault anyway. Like, I'm here because of, you know, bad eating habits. So, you know, I'm complaining, I'm acting entitled about a thing that is likely my fault, and also nothing like real problems that other people have. And it's all very, you know, it's all degrees or whatever. And we can only have our own experience, but I think it's easy to get trapped into that thinking of just that whole why me thing. So for me, that's always a challenge to go, oh, well, this is hard. Why is this so hard? This shouldn't be that hard. And then to then be reminded that, oh, well, wait, this isn't all that hard at all. And actually, there's a lot of really great things about this thing, that whatever it is. And I know some people who would probably kill for these challenges and these things being hard. So why am I complaining? And I tend to waffle between those two spheres.
Right. I think that's pretty normal. I think that's pretty normal. And I think the why me question is so human, right? It is, and bizarrely so, because it's so irrational, right? Statistically, we know someone's got to get cancer out of us 10 people, right?
Yeah.
And so we often ask, why me? Instead, if we asked, why not me? Like, really? Because there's this thing, there's a specialness we all think we have. Right. Mm-hmm. Is that the right word? It's sort of like,
it is. I think we all think we're a unique little snowflake.
Yeah, we do. And that's really important for some people to feel or to think. And I think even if that's not what you're actively thinking, I think it pops up when something bad happens to you, because when we hear about it on the news, or we have, you know, a friend of a friend has a something or other, we think, oh, that's so terrible. Okay, now I'm off to the mall to buy my favorite shoes. Because here is where your little bout with your health thing last year, what it did was it inconvenienced you. It woke you up to the frailty of your body. Mm-hmm. It woke you up to the consequences of your choices. This is why the young people, the youth today.
Oh my gosh,
it sounds so old.
So old right now, yeah.
But they really don't appreciate anything, because there's not a lot that slows them down, right? So the reality of again, aging, which all of us get to do, is that it starts to slow things down or impacts, you know, we get injured or there's a health thing or, you know, it's all of those things that can just interrupt the constant flow of busyness in our lives. I mean, isn't that your experience where you are so busy and then your gold filling tooth falls out, right?
Yeah, oh, gosh, dang it,
and
dude.
You just think, what? Why?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Right? No, I just went through this like 2 weeks ago. I had a filling fall out for no reason with a piece of bread. And to me, that was like, really?
What in the world? And it was a very busy, stressful week. Taylor was getting married. You had so much going on, like to have that. So I think this is just inevitable, right? That the more stressed and busy you are, the more likely your tires are going to pop or your tooth is going to fall out or something that you normally can abuse and neglect and ignore to pop up because you're neglecting more things because you're stressed and busy. Right. So I think there's something, I'm going to call it cosmic, that is sort of helpful in this regard, that we have these things that pop up in our lives to slow us down or to stop us or to get us to be maybe more thoughtful or aware of other people or those type of things that just bring maybe more balance in our lives.
Right.
Because it is inevitable. There is not a person I talk to who doesn't have, I like to say it happens in threes, right? But they'll have three things that are really hard happen at one time and it just almost halts, you know, the normal progression of their lives. And so this is an acute example, something frustrating happens that slows everything down. But I think it's true of any of these longer term things is they throw us off our routine. And some people really need routine to feel sort of sane. And then others sort of thrive more on change. Do you know anyone that thrives on change? Like, personally,
I would argue that you do.
Yeah, I do.
You like it. You like that a lot. And you like big drastic ones. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't mean just, oh, now Wendy's in Sweden, therefore she's the change queen. You've always been like this, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, you do. Kim likes it a lot, my wife.
Yeah.
She loves it. You know, like if you can tell if we're going to be in a house for 6 to 7 years. I know that right around that sixth or seventh year, I will start to hear, hey, we should move, or hey, I have another idea, or whatever. Like, that's just kind of her thing. If I told her today, honey, drop everything. We have to fly to Amsterdam and bring home Amsterdam pot right now, immediately. We have to smuggle it back to the country. She would get excited about this idea. Not because it's pot. The pot part is not the exciting part, but it's the kind of like, okay, let's go. What do we need to
adventure.
Do? Yeah, she loves adventure and she loves being, I mean, sometimes you could walk up to her and say, hey, we need to feed 500 people right now. She'd go, all right. And she'd go to it. She'd figure it out.
She'd say, do we have any allergies? Are you vegetarian? Done.
Yep, done. Here's what we're going to do. It's fettuccine for everybody, whatever. She really thrives on that. And I know a few other people like that, but more often I know people who don't like change or who like to put down roots or whatever. I don't necessarily think they're, you know, unhappy or at a disadvantage, but it's just definitely a different way of thinking.
Right. And I'll tell you, that is all it is a way of thinking. So I'm sure there's things Kim does that, you know, she should shift her narrative in order to be happier. Right. But when it comes to change, her narrative is she's good to go. And that's interesting. And I will go for it. And that means that there's not all the resistance, right? Because really the torture of change is how we resist it. Mm. And it is so, it's about safety. It's about comfort. It's about a lot of things for a lot of people for a lot of reasons, right?
Yeah.
So I love change. I love adventure. Let's do something new. Same old thing is so hard for me. This is why I don't miss home at all. Like, I really have not had 5 seconds of homesickness.
Really?
But part of that is just, I know exactly what that is. And I don't know what is here. And so it's all new and exciting and I can find, you know, reasons to appreciate it. But I also think we tend to, the story could be, because the story, I've had a lot of people here that I've met, like, are you guys okay? Like, you know how bad the weather's going to be. Which I don't know if this is like, I think it's a general human thing, but man, Swedes, get over your weather, right?
Yeah.
Like, I get it. We're like, it's the north, it's going to be cold, it's windy, it's rainy, whatever. Like, shut up. It's beautiful almost every day. And all they can say is, okay, but it's going to get bad.
Well, yeah, but that's the whole, you can't see outside your own view. You know what I mean? Like, that, isn't that, right. isn't that them just, that's just them doing what we do or anyone else
exactly.
does.
Exactly. And yeah. that, and you know what? What it is it's set, I'm realizing how human Swedes are, how much like Americans they are and how much they're not as well like Americans, but that you, there, it's human nature to be like, don't get too excited about this beautiful fall weather every day because winter's coming,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And what does that do to for someone? Mm. That makes you not appreciate today and then worry about and sort of hunker down like, oh no, what's this going to be like? Mm-hmm. As opposed to, you know what I'm excited for? This is the coolest thing in the world. They, when the lakes freeze here,
yeah.
they measure how deep the freezing is, and it's if it's at least 60 centimeters, they put a track on the freaking lake, and you can drive your car.
Oh, no way.
Yes.
You can just take any, just whatever car you have, and you go drive it.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's that you can just use whatever car, but the people I've talked to have done it said it is the biggest rush, because you're afraid you're going to fall in every minute, right?
Yeah.
But you're not.
Yeah.
Because yeah, there's safety crazy here, too, at the same time. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
And then, but you go so fast and you slide. And anyway, it's supposed to be so fun. And people
like fun.
Ice skate on these lakes and everyone carries spikes and a whistle and a glow in the dark thing because you got to be safe, but mm-hmm. you're still ice skating on a lake in the dark.
That's great.
So when they're like, oh no, winter's coming. I'm like, oh yes, it's going to be amazing.
Yeah, but this is just you. You do this.
Right. Sure. Sure. That's true. But the key is, what story am I telling myself? I'm telling myself that there's something good about the change. And this is not fooling yourself. There's a difference between, let me just do positive self-talk and, you know, that everything's going to be fine. However, there is research to support that that does work. We will believe that voice in our head, but most of us have trained that voice in our head to say it's going to go bad. The weather's going to suck. You're going to hate it. That's the frustrating part. Is that voice gets a lot of airtime in one direction or another and then seems to just happen naturally, right?
Yeah.
So whoever's listening.
This is my problem, by the way. You just described what I do.
Yeah.
I hate it. I hate that. Yeah. I hate that I do that. I hate that I see, trying to think of an example here. Like, I hate concerts now. I hate them. Why? Because they're packed with people. Everybody stinks. It's too close proximity. You can't get anywhere. I can't really enjoy the music. You're standing the whole time. It just sounds like crap to me now. Now, I think I think it's fair to have a genuine dislike for an experience like that and say, sure. Well, I don't want to do that anymore. But I can never go, oh my gosh, this is the last time Rush will ever tour and they're awesome. And wouldn't it be great to be like, I never can look at it that way anymore. I only have this vision of ugh, hot, sweaty, gross. I'll listen to them on my iPod. This is lame. Like, it's just, it's immediate and automatic for me when it comes to certain experiences like that. Whereas Kim's like, dude, we are totally going. Like, she caught wind that there was going to be some band somewhere and a knife party, I think. She loves those guys. And she goes, oh, we are so going. And I said, when you say we, you mean like you and Carter, right? Because I'm not going to that. So it's just, you know, I don't think I'm alone. Like, a lot of people get this way, depending on what it is. I mean, you know, if you're really into something, you're into it and you don't see it that way. But like skiing to me isn't fun. It's wet and cold and kind of miserable. And I live in beautiful ski country here.
Yeah, and it's such a waste.
Ugh. And I still have that attitude. I always have sort of. I did it a lot when I was a kid, but that's just because that's what you did. And your friends went and everybody did their thing. But now that I can make my own adult decisions, it's like, I don't want to go skiing. That's lame.
Yeah, I'm never doing that again.
Yeah. And I don't like that about me because it's just so locked in. It's just very hard for me to change the way I see it.
Right.
And that's what you're saying is, well, you're not saying you need to change it so much, but your point is that some can see it and see that change as a good thing. Or even be able to look past a bad experience and say, well, that was then and now we can have a good one. Like I admire right. people that have a terrible experience with something and they can just go right back. For example, this is a bad example. Let's say you go to a Taco Bell. It's the worst food poisoning outbreak in the history of ever. It's the worst,
oh
right?
Oh, my gosh.
Well, a lot of people, including me, would just never go to Taco Bell again.
Right.
Like, I can't eat Cheetos for this reason because they made me sick when I was younger, and I still can't eat them. For Kim, it was when
she's probably a good thing.
It's probably a good thing, and these aren't as comparable. But there is a tendency, don't you think, for people to have a bad experience and then have it solely a thing they thought they were into, and then trying to muster up excitement for that thing again after you had such a bad experience. That's really hard for people.
Well, actually, the food is a really good example, because it shows you how ancient this wiring really is, how sort of deep it goes, because food is a perfect example that we are created, wired, developed to not eat bad food, right? Yeah. That is why when food has a smell, I mean, we're so in tune to how it smells, the color. That's why we like perfect looking fruit, even though it's covered in plastic, because that means it's not, there's no worms, it's not poisonous, it's, you know, healthy for us. We're so wired to see food in that regard, so we don't get sick and die, right? There's a good reason. Like, I can't even look at a Panda Express logo. Does that, you know, tell you about how badly really, I was poisoned by those people?
Were you really? I
can't
didn't know
even
about
look
this.
At a logo.
Bad time, yeah, had was, a bad time there. I didn't know that.
When we were first married, whatever Adam got had all the poison, and I had like two bites of his and then ate something else. So I was not half as sick. But I still, to this day, I know where one is, and I look the other way. Like, I can't even. And you know what? That is so advantageous. And that is, we don't want that to ever break down, or we're all going to be really ill, right? We need that.
It's just that in a modern context, it comes off as, it seems silly from the outside, because of course, not every location of Panda Express is going to give you food poisoning. And even that one location probably never will again if you go there 150 times. It's just that we're taking wiring from a time where we ate those berries on a bush in a time where, you know, whatever, man was much more primitive, and we ate those berries and they made us super sick and we didn't want to go near that bush again. That served us to know, or we watched our brother eat them and die, and that served us. We went, all right, that's not berries we're going to eat then, because those killed that guy. Awesome. Everyone's learned their lesson.
And there's the narrative.
Yeah.
Do not eat the purple berries with the black spiky things. Whatever.
Right. Whatever it is. But the problem is, in modern contexts, we apply the same wiring to that plane had to emergency land and the landing gear was broken and we barely made it out. We should have all died in a giant fireball. Right. I'm never flying again. Well, statistically, that's dumb, and all kinds of other reasons that's dumb. But the wiring still says, no, your survival now depends on you not taking a plane in the air again, because that happened last time, you know?
And maybe this makes me a hypocrite, but I do not recommend exposure therapy with food poisoning at a crappy restaurant.
No.
Like, I'm going to get over Pan Express and just keep going back until I get over this.
No.
Don't do that.
Well, you might but would you if it hadn't happened to you, though? Do you know what I mean? Like, if a patient came to you and said, I can't go to restaurants anymore. Why? Because I've been food poisoned 3 times. So what do you tell them? Shouldn't they go? Maybe not to the ones they got sick at, but, you know, maybe they're having a problem.
It depends. If they were like, I just really don't want to go to restaurants, I'd be like, cool. That would be better for the whole human race if we ate a little more family dinner.
That's a good point.
But if it was like, I love restaurants, I love going out, I feel like I'm missing out on my life now because I'm so paranoid, that would be a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
And exposure therapy does work that way, because what happens is we are wiring. We have a new created memory with that next experience, and we reduce the power of the old story by increasing more positive outcomes, right? And you'll find people that can continually adjust the story to be positive, right? They just seem to see the glass half full, right? That's why we have that adage, is that there are definitely those who are going to say, well, I'll probably get food poisoning no matter what I do. And that's just the way they're going to view the world. And those people are definitely wired a little more strongly in that direction. And then the people who are too optimistic or too, you know, stupid end up dying. They don't procreate, and we weed them out of the society.
I mean, it's terrible, but you're right.
Right. But you have to find, first of all, I think, okay, so anyone listening, I'm going to make this really practical.
All right.
If this is ringing true to you, you're thinking, okay, I hate change. It's scary. It ends up bad. Blah, blah, blah. Sit down with a piece of paper and write down everything you think about change, right? Mm. You have a narrative about change. You might listen to my story and think, she's nuts. why in the world would she take her kids? And I'll tell you what's really socially, scientifically interesting is how we have brainwashed our children to think like we do about Sweden.
Yeah.
Like every night we're like, what do you love about Sweden? And then we'll say, oh, I love this or I love this. And I mean, and it's not like we're not allowing them to say negative things, because we'll say, okay, because you guys want to talk about anything that's bugging you.
Mm-hmm.
And Abe will say, man, sometimes I just want to talk to an American kid. I'm like, cool, let's Skype a friend. Or, yeah, you know, Elliot's, I forgot what his complaint was, something stupid. And then, you know, whatever. But they have these like barely anything. But then every day they're just sort of telling us they're so happy to be here and how exciting, because we have given them the narrative. We have trained them how to think about this.
Right.
Right. And that is probably true for most people listening. If they have a very strong negative narrative about something, is they heard it from somewhere else, or maybe they had a firsthand experience, but usually, you know, our family, everyone's scared of bees.
Yeah.
Because mom is scared of bees.
Yeah, pretty much.
Right.
Yeah.
And the first time I freaked out when I saw a bee, P.S. I've never been stung.
Yeah.
I have no reason logically to be afraid of bees. I still haven't been stung by one. And Adam's like, he was like a dad in the moment. He's like, you know what? The Dunford part of this family is not going to do that.
Right.
I was like, whoa.
Right.
And so I just held my breath and relaxed, and the bee never touched me and I was fine.
Yeah.
And I watched my kids. So should we film your children around bees and then film my children around bees?
Oh, my. Yeah.
Well, and it's because Adam refused to let that narrative be in my family.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Don't let that one carry through if you can.
Yeah. And it's useless and dumb and it doesn't really mean anything, but it's sort of the power of how you can influence young people's narrative. So think back in your own life. So you're sitting down with your piece of paper, write down how you feel about change. Look at the sentences you're writing. See if you hear those in anyone else's voices but your own. Like, do you hear your mom saying, you don't own the power company or whatever. What do you hear your mom saying in her voice about scarcity, right?
Yeah.
Or abundance. Who knows? These could be positive, but like, where are you hearing it? Who's it from? And then how does that play, that narrative? How is that playing? It's like your background life montage music, right?
Yeah.
That this is scary. That's hard. Don't do that. Whatever. You have to first identify the narrative, where it comes from, and then really ask yourself, okay, what if I change that to like, this might be good, and then see the impact. We know this from some athletic studies and sports psychology, that the way a player thinks about something, that's why they do the psyching up, right? Like, we're going to win. This is great. We're going to win. Is so crucial to performance, is that, you know, this can be a really hard game and you guys are probably, you know, it's going to take everything you have and you may not win, is not going to help them play better.
Right. Right.
So that's kind of an example of it, but you really need to identify it first. So this is first steps for most people, but like really look at why you think a certain way about something. And then the question is not, wow, this is going to be hard or not. The question is, where did this narrative come from? And is there a way to flip it? Or is there a way to change it, ignore it, walk away from it, jump in headfirst anyway? I don't know. The question is not, am I right or wrong about the narrative? The question is, how do I switch this to something else or try something else? And just,
well, and the key part seems to be understanding why it's there in the first place. Understanding why you're afraid of bees, as your example, or, you know, why my kids are afraid of haunted houses. They're afraid of haunted houses because of their sister. Because there's a narrative in my family, which was Taylor was 12 and went with some friends to a haunted house. It was an old hospital in the 1800s. I mean, this thing was genuinely terrifying. Horrible building. They went
in
there.
Is this the state hospital in Provo?
No, it's that Lehigh old crumbly one that's now gone, but used to be. I know, super scary. And not even structurally sound, I don't think. But anyway, she went with these friends because there was all this pressure to go and she wasn't really sure, but I was like, it'll be fine, sweetie. This stuff's all fake. She came home and first of all, had a terrible time in there. Was just miserable. Cried all night and spent probably 2-3 weeks with nightmares and it was bad. Yeah. And she's, you know, whatever. She's kind of a sensitive soul. She sees these things and they affect her.
Yeah.
But I remember the effect was not so much on her as it was the other two watching this. going, yeah. Oh, that's what that is. Okay. And they
never doing that.
Yeah. Carter has no desire to go near one. Right. Nick is going to go with some friends here soon. And it's a real challenge for him. And again, that quote unquote narrative we keep talking about was laid down pretty thick by their sister, and it's never gone away since they were, and they would have been really impressionable ages. They would have been like, I guess Carter would have been 9 and Nick would have been 6 or something.
Yeah.
And they never forgot that. And it exists in all kinds of ways, whether it's simple, silly fears like that or big giant ones. Like, I don't know what the narrative is that makes it so Carter doesn't want to drive. I cannot figure this one out. She just doesn't want to do it. She hates it. And I don't know who gave her that, because everyone in the family is excited to drive, loves driving, great driving records. Nick can't wait. Taylor loved it, couldn't get her license quick enough. Carter.
You really don't know where this comes from.
I really don't. No. Because remember, I got my license a year late. Okay. This is known fact. But it wasn't because I was afraid of driving.
Who cares what it was? You were still a year late.
Well, yeah, but I agree. But it doesn't.
What I'm saying is, an excited, ready to drive kind of person. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, it a year late.
No, you're right. Right? Yeah,
hold on. And then, if anyone's ever seen Scott and Kim in a car, who's driving?
Because she hates it when I drive.
It's never you.
She hates it when I drive. She hates it. I know.
I'm just saying, we don't get to dictate how our narratives come across to our kids. They just pick them up.
So what do you think she's taking away from that? Like, what is she getting from, dad's lazy and didn't do it for a year, or mom really prefers to drive because she thinks doesn't like the way dad drives? Like, how is she turning that into, I never want to drive?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's that you guys let her get away with the narrative too. Like, okay, then.
Probably a little bit. I mean, part of that is definitely there is this thing. Like, we've made a deal. I said, look, if you get your license, I will bungee jump, which is one of my horrible
fears. Oh, my gosh.
I know. I don't want to do it. I hate heights so much. Heights are the worst for me. So I told her I'd do it, and she's now considering it because she wants to see me freak myself out and jump on a bungee. But most of it has been – now she's just stubborn about it. Like, I'll live in the city. No, just public transportation and bikes and blah, 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 like all this. She has all these plans on how people live in San Francisco or Chicago or whatever. And even Salt Lake. And I've tried to explain to her that, yeah, that's fine, but you need to kind of, there's all these reasons to have it. She's right in one way. I mean, she's basically giving me the argument, well, dad, this is just some construct of society that it's important that you have this thing. Like, she's playing that card,
I love it.
It's something I would have totally done at her age.
Yeah. I wonder where she gets all this from.
Probably me. But the point, I'm not sure what the point is, because in a thousand other ways, she's nothing like me. Like, she, if you said, hey, like tomorrow, somebody came and said, we've got one spot left on the next shuttle. We're going to Mars for the first time. You'll live and die there. And, it's the first colonization and we have one spot. It's not going to cost you anything. Normally these are $20 million, but we're going to get one in. Carter would raise her hand and go, let's go. I would go, give me a second. Let me think about this. stuff I like to do here, but she's got her mom's adventurousness in every way, except for the stupid car.
That's so funny.
And zombie movies. I can't get her to watch a zombie movie at all.
Well, there's a good reason.
She's
there.
Terrified of those.
Disturbing.
She can't deal with it, but I like zombie movies and I like post-apocalyptic tales.
I love bungee jumping.
Yeah. See, you're crazy too. Everyone's nuts. But anyway, the point is change. It's not easy. So bring paper money and you won't have to do. Oh, wait, wrong kind of change.
Have change.
Yeah. I hope this helps somebody out there maybe facing big change in their life, whether it be, family or work or whatever. Your feedback is always encouraged. So send us more of that. I have no idea what our final two episodes are, but we'll let people know what they're going to be, because that's where we're at.
Somebody send in like an awesome email. Like, I like the. I don't know.
Maybe these last two we will glean from some kicking emails. And they can't just be, I don't know how to ask my girlfriend out. I mean, we're looking for something that's like.
Yeah. We got to BS about it for an hour, people. So give us something good.
Yeah, it's got to be something solid. And if not, we'll find. There's plenty of general topics. But if if something grabs our eye in the next week or so, you might be the subject of our final two episodes of this season. So stay tuned for all of that. In the meantime, you are welcome and can and always are welcome to go over to frogpants.com/therapy. Contact details are there, subscription info, previous episodes, all that stuff is right there. So if you've missed the show or you want to catch it in a different way, it's all right there for you. I think that's going to do it. Thanks, Wendy.
All right. Peace out.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next time.
So good, it's like you're there!